You know, I have friends who like to go to sleep with a sound machine. I hear the rain. To me, going to sleep, a sound machine, it would have to be poker chips with my father screaming, "God damn it, Mariana, straight does not beat a flush." You know, I grew up listening to this, and that's how I knew I was home safe.
All right. Debbie, where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I am originally from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is right outside of Philadelphia, which always confuses people that don't know geography.
It's more of a suburb.
They're like, how can New Jersey be outside of Philadelphia? I'm like, all right, there's a little river separates Jersey, South Jersey.
It's more of a suburb of Philadelphia than it is.
Yeah. Very big suburb of Philadelphia. All the mafia from Philadelphia ended up moving and creating this – starting this suburb in South Jersey.
What was your family like growing up?
Well, my parents, both heavy drinkers. I call them alcoholic, but you're not really supposed to because it's a self-diagnosed disease. But it was the swinging 50s and 60s after the war. They had four kids, and if you ask my mom why she had four kids, she would say, I don't know, because it was going around and your father wanted a big family, you know. She did not like being a mother. She was trapped in this miserable existence of the suburbs in the 50s, and she was a smart woman, and it was not a good place for a smart woman to be, you know. If she'd had the wherewithal, I mean, there were women that were succeeding at the time, but she should have been running a corporation. Instead, she was running a household of three insane boys and me. And so she drank a lot. She and her friends every day would gather at my house. I'd come home from school and the women would all be drinking already, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd come home with a problem and my mother would be like, "What, you know, cigarettes, all them cigarettes, bourbon, you know." And I'd want to talk to my mother, and she'd say, "Have a cookie. Go have a cookie." So that was my nurturing, a cookie. That became my first, you know, my first addiction, really, was cookies. My father started as a traveling salesman, and he became successful in the company, and he was in New York City. So he commuted every day to New York City and spent a lot of nights up there. And I grew up with three brothers, and it was a wild household. Because my parents were both pretty alcoholic, and their disease was progressing. And as their disease progressed, there were less boundaries in the house. There were less rules. There was more cookies. You know, I mean, more whatever. What do you do? Okay. If they punished one of my brothers, if he got punished, he would jump out the window and run away until my parents took the punishment off him, and then he would come back. So my parents had, like, no control over my three brothers, particularly when the mid-60s came around. Dad was German. Mom was, as I say, half Scotch. You know, the other half bitter. So they had a good sense of family. They instilled a sense of loyalty to your family. But there was absolutely no emotional infrastructure, you know. I had no one to talk to if I had a problem. I remember when I first started menstruating, my mother sent me to 7-Eleven with my father. It was the most humiliating moment of my life, you know. Mom was just not available. And I think what my dad did is he came in and he overcompensated for that. He saw that my mother was not present, you know. Particularly, she was very stoic. You know, her family was Mormon. I mean, her relatives are Mormons. And her parents left the church because they wanted to drink. So my mother's immediate family, my uncles and her, were not raised in the Mormon faith, but all of her relatives, you know, always talked about your family crossed the Rocky Mountains in the cold, hard winter. And when they got hungry, they didn't eat each other. You know, they ate rocks and sticks. You know, you come from tough people. So one of her aunts, my great aunt, would fly to visit us. And she was a Mormon, and she would fly to visit us. And she'd walk in the front door ordering a drink. "Oh, scotch on the rocks." And I'm like, "I thought Mormons didn't drink." She was like, "Oh, that's just in Utah. This is New Jersey. We can drink here, you know." So my parents were atheists. My father was leaving a pretty oppressive white Anglo-Saxon Presbyterian group of, you know, parenting and relatives, and my mom was coming from the oppression of the Mormon church. And they were both like these intellectual atheists. There was no God growing up. And when I tell people that, they say, "Well, what religion?" I'm like, "No, you're not listening. There was no religion. My parents thought religion was bullshit." You know, my father, Sunday mornings, they'd be drinking Bloody Marys, making fun of the people. "Look at all the lemmings going off to church. What a bunch of idiots. What a bunch of lemmings. Go, go, go. What a bunch of weaklings. Go," you know. And some of my girlfriends were obviously Catholic or Jewish or whatever. And I would come home and say, "Mommy, I want to go to Sunday school with Susie." And she would say, "Be my guest." You know, they didn't restrict me. "You do what you want, but it's bullshit," you know. So I'd go off to Sunday school with a friend one time and go, "Ew, I didn't like that." And I mean, literally, I think I went to Sunday school once in my life. And the only time I went to church at all, ever, until I left that home was a wedding. Or I went to temple because my best friend was Jewish and she got bat mitzvahed. A couple weddings, couple funerals, and that was it. And I grew up with this incredible fear of God and religion. I'm still not a big fan of religion, but I'm very much a live and let live person. You know, you do you, I'll do me. So very hardcore atheist, very cynical, and as their disease, I don't know if you know anything about alcoholism, but as their alcoholism progressed, and I don't know this at the time, but looking back, I'm sober now, and I look back on what happened as their disease progressed, as they got older, the boundaries got worsened, and the parenting got, you know, more lackadaisical, and the household just became very, very chaotic. I mean, my mother tells a story about playing bridge with her. You know, my mother was a society lady, or so she thought, and she'd be playing bridge in the living room, and my two brothers, maybe they were 5 and 7 at the time, would come running down in their underwear chasing each other. "I'm going to kill you, you motherfucker!" And they would run each through the house with each other. And my mother would just be playing bridge with her girlfriends, and she would go, "Excuse me." And she would put the cards down, and she would go off and say, "Get upstairs." I mean, she just led this dichotomy. There's a story in the 70s. My parents had bridge partners over on a Saturday night. And I had an older brother named Reed who has sadly died, but he was dealing drugs out of his back bedroom. He had a back bedroom. He was dealing drugs out of there during high school. And my two younger brothers were his best customers. I'm still pretty straight at the time, because apparently I figured out early on that if my brothers are all going to be the rapscallions, the only way I'm going to get attention around here is for me to be the good girl. So I was a good girl for as long as I possibly could. And so there's a story. They're all playing bridge, and there's a knock on the door. And my father, "Reed here." Some hippies go upstairs, knock on the doors. "Reed here." Hippies go upstairs. It's a Saturday night. And after about an hour, my father's bridge partner turns to him and he goes, "Are you aware that there's 22 hippies in Reed's bedroom right now?" And my parents were like, "Whatever." My parents let him smoke pot And him and all of our friends smoked pot. I was allowed to because I was a little younger and I was the girl. And once I got involved with the drugs, my parents put a kibosh on it. Like, oh, no, that's it. That's it. But I think they figured that they'd rather we stay home and do whatever we're going to do than go out and get in cars and drive around and get arrested and get drunk and all that. So it was a very typical late 60s, early 70s. I say typical. It wasn't typical at all. I thought it was. I thought everybody's family was like this. My parents drank heavy every single day, and every weekend they had poker parties. You know, I have friends who go to who like to go to sleep with a sound machine. I hear the rain. To me, going to sleep, a sound machine, it would have to be poker chips with my father screaming, God damn it, Mariana, straight does not beat a flush. You know, I grew up listening to this, and that's how I knew I was home safe, and my parents were there, and their friends were there, and everything was good. And I would make my dad his drinks. From the time I was old enough to look over the kitchen counter, I became the bartender. I was the world's first 9-year-old bartender. And I would, of course, taste the drinks. In fact, I think I tasted my first drink probably at about age 5 or 6. And I was mixing a drink for my father, and I'm using my chubby little finger as a swizzle stick. And I just get the big idea to, you know, taste it. And I remember this very well. Just my sensories remember. It was like, But I didn't stop. I kept tasting it until it tasted good, because I knew that when I grew up, I'd have to drink it. So I went off to college, and it was the 70s, and it was, you know, people talk about how crazy the 60s were. 70s, they made the 60s look like the 50s. The 70s were insane because there was nothing to protest. We didn't even have a point. We just had drugs, sex, rock and roll. And there was so much sex in the 70s, of course, that you could have it by mistake. You know, like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know. But I went to a very liberal college in southern Vermont that literally on our opening day, our indoctrination with the dean of students, that you have to meet in the field house to get your hello. And he told us all right, you could all smoke pot in the dorms, whatever. I ask one thing. Parents weekend, October 24th, can you please not smoke pot in the dorms for that weekend? I remember everybody going, well, I don't know. I don't know if I can do that. It was a very wild time. And I just had this feeling or premise that there was anything goes, you know? Whatever, Deb, go get it. And I did. I became, you know, pretty quickly, I hooked up with a very heavy drinking student friend of mine. We fell in love and we're in this extremely abusive alcoholic relationship, which I did not know wasn't normal. You know, I never saw my father hit my mother. I'm sure he never did. But they also just kind of did their own thing. You know, they didn't even try to pretend like they were having this happy love with these four beautiful kids. I mean, it was like they'd already blown it and they knew it. And so I got into this relationship with, I fell madly in love. I mean, insanely in love. It was my first love. I mean, there had been some other guys, but, you know, I didn't know their names or anything. And this guy comes along and we're both kind of you know, big theater mucky mucks, and we're doing plays, and we're drinking, and we're acting like we're Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, and we're having barroom brawls in front of everybody. You know, we're 19 and 20 years old. And it was fun to me at the time. It was just really exciting because I'm like totally in my addiction at this point. I'm totally drinking like there's no, you know, my idea of stopping at this point in my life is passing out. That's when I stopped drinking for the night. And he was worse. He made me look like, you know, a teetotaler the way he drank. And so we hung out together and drank and fought and broke up. And, you know, one night he started strangling me in front of the entire theater department. I guess I said something he didn't like, and he just grabs me by the neck and starts to strangle me. And I think we're doing an improv. You know, we're at a theater party. Everybody's kind of drunk. And I'm like, oh, help, help, I'm being strangled. But he doesn't stop. And nobody, at first nobody's paying attention. And I'm screaming, help, 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 you know. And nobody helped me. Nobody stopped him. And when I broke free and I said to everybody, what the fuck? Why didn't you people help me? They were like, well, We thought you were putting on a skit. So it was very Virginia, well, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, he and I, you know. They never knew when we were screwing around or when we were real, when it was really dangerous. And that went on and on and on. And it took me many, many, many years to break free of that cycle. I mean, no other guy ever abused me. And he never really abused me after that. But it wasn't a healthy, it was really toxic, really, really toxic. But to me, at the time, it was, you know, this was before there was so much awareness of women being abused or abusive. We just didn't have that awareness. We didn't even have the awareness of alcoholism. At least I didn't. You know, I didn't know. I didn't know anything. I thought I was just living my life in Vermont, having a grand old time. So, you know, I moved on to New York City, and this guy and I had many more episodes, and I could just never totally get him out of my life or my mind or my thoughts. It was just, we've since reconciled and made amends with each other, and we're pretty convinced, we're both sober, we're both pretty convinced that we have, like, past lives together, because there's just no way the connection that we have happened between two 18-year-olds in Vermont over a beer. There was this connect, this just, I can't not, you know? And there's such a thing as a soul flame. This is going to get a little California woo-woo, but there's such a thing as a soul flame, which is like beyond soulmate. It's two people, two souls who have had many past lives together, and they're doomed. And their purpose in this life is to continually try to make, the purpose in any life is to try to make it work. And if they're within, you know, states of each other, they'll find each other to try to make it work. Doesn't mean it does ever work. Doesn't mean they ever get it right in this life plane, if you believe in that. And I don't, you know, I don't know, so I believe anything's possible. I kind of believe in anything, including Santa Claus. It's all possible. I've had a lot of evidence. So, you know, I bought him out in New York City as this alcoholic. My disease took me to the point where I would, well, needless to say, I drove everywhere drunk. This was before Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And if the cops pulled you over and you were a young blonde girl, American, they would say, oh, You're cute. Why are you so drunk, honey? All right, just go ahead. Go over the George Washington Bridge back into New York City. Don't come to New Jersey drunk again. I just got pulled over. Because you hear stories these days of people like, oh, I got a DWI and I went to jail, so I went and sobered up. Nobody did me any favors. I drank for 20 years being completely, you know, co-signed by I probably got pulled over 3 or 4 times. Seriously, shit-faced drunk. No business driving, you know? I mean, I drank so much in that era, I could have taken my DMV picture like this, you know? I was a mess. And so I sobered up in New York City because I bottomed out a lot of different times. I bottomed out on stage one night doing stand-up comedy. I'm a comic. And some guy pulled a gun on me from the audience. And he was kind of kidding, and I was kind of kidding. The audience didn't like me at all. They're all like, hey, you, it was West Virginia, and they just, it wasn't a match. And I'm on stage just trying to do my 40 minutes so I can get my money. And someone screams out, you the stripper, you know, you suck. Everybody's like, yeah, bleh. I mean, I have beer bottles thrown at me. And all, like I said, all I got to do is last 40 minutes so I can get paid. And this guy in the audience pulls out a gun. This redneck pulls a gun out of his boot. And, you know, I think a normal person, I'm still drinking at the time. I think a normal person would have, like, all right, that's it. I'm out of here. But I didn't. I just stood there and I went, go ahead, shoot me. I don't care. I'll probably be a celebrity the way things, you know, it was during the whole Mary Jo Buttafuoco and Lorena Bobbitt. It was the beginning of the whole era when people were becoming famous for crimes. I don't think you're quite as old as I am, but there was a moment in time when America became that. It pretty much began with Mark Chapman, who shot John Lennon. And, you know, Canada was so interesting. Mark Chapman, I think he was Canadian, but they would not say his name or show his picture anywhere in Canada after he shot John Lennon. America, all over the place, made him famous. You know, and then it went on from there. So people were like getting book deals from violent crimes, you know, getting talk shows and, you know, touring the country. You know, Mary Jo Buttafuoco, who got shot in the head, was like on stage every night. So I start riffing with this guy with his gun. You know, she got shot and she's famous. Make me famous. Come on. I don't have a career. Blah. So that's what made the guy pull the gun out. And he's just holding me in his aim. And I don't stop. I don't stop. And finally, fortunately, he did not shoot me. But the manager came in and pulled me off stage and, you know, threw my money at me, threw me out the door. And I just, you know, drove off to the next gig drinking.
What happened to the guy?
No, Skeeter, he probably owned the place. I don't know, you know? He didn't get thrown out. Oh, no, it was all me.
It's a different world down there from New York City.
Well, it absolutely is. And then the bit that I was improvising when he pulled out the gun about all the fame and the crime, I decided it was a good idea to go actually work on it and make it a bit because it was funny. And I started doing that all over the East Coast as a comic. And that made a whole other group of people pull weapons out on me. I mean, it brought. So then I sobered up, and I kind of looked around, went, "All right, this is not what I." Because I wanted to be an actress. I was trying to be an actress, and I ended up doing comedy kind of by mistake. I have nothing but respect for comedy, and I love it, and all of that. But it just wasn't where I would have gone had I not been the drunk that I was, because I literally started doing comedy when I heard that the comedians drank for free. I'm like, really? Where do I sign up? I'm funny. So I left New York City, and I come out here trying to get this career going. And the whole, you know, for about 20 years, I did not allow myself a relationship, really, not beyond, you know, a couple nights, whatever. My heart was still broken from this guy. We had had many more incarnations of this little sick twist we were in. And I move out to L.A., and I'm just – everything's happening for me, and it's all I had done this show, this one-woman show, and there was all this heat on me, and now I go from being, you know, being on the roadkill circuit in West Virginia and Florida. All of a sudden, I'm in Hollywood, and I got agents and managers, and, you know, I'm writing for sitcoms, and I get a sitcom deal of my own, and everything's about to happen. And for reasons I still am not quite sure of, it all kind of dissipated. I'm sober now. But, you know, just when you, just because you sober up doesn't mean you're normal yet. You know, you got some work to do. Because my entire personality had been formed by, you know, a bar drunk. One on the road, you know? I mean, that was, I came of age there and I was like, you know, that was my whole thing. So, my career just goes like this, and then it just falls off the clip, and I'm left back with nothing. And the last night that I'm doing my show, when all the networks decide that they're all going to pass, nobody wants to build a sitcom around me, and there's a guy in the audience that somebody had brought to meet me. Friend was setting me up. I've, like I said, I'm sober a couple years now, but I'm still kind of crazy because you are, you know, you are. I mean, I wasn't normal to begin with, but I, of course, I don't know any of this at the time. You know, there's a reason you drink. Normal, happy, healthy people don't generally pick up a drink and continue to drink that same moment until they pass out. Just isn't the way it goes. But I believe I have the gene. I believe I was born an alcoholic, but a lot of people are born with a gene and they don't ever, you know, go down the gutter. But then there's those of us who did. So this guy gets brought to the show to meet me, and I walk out after the show and I say hello to him, and I'm like, whatever, he's not my type. He's nice. I'm not interested. I just, you know, I like the bad boys. He's not wearing a black leather jacket. What am I going to do with this guy, you know? So I walk away, and the very next morning, and this is all 100% true of the way this happened, the very next morning I wake up and my manager calls me to reiterate that everyone was passing. Yeah, everybody's passing. Nobody wants you, kid. Nobody wants, you know. People that didn't even see the show are passing. You know, you're nowhere. We're nowhere. And I'm like, well, what now? She goes, basically, not my problem. Bye-bye. So I get in my car to go buy my plan. The only thing I could think to do is to rent a sad movie. And this is before cell phones. You know, this is the mid-90s. Rent a sad movie, buy some ice cream, and I'm going to eat and weep until I slip into a coma. That's my whole plan. So I'm at a red light. I'm sobbing. I mean, everything that I had gone for. The whole time while I was a drunk, I still thought I was going to be this huge star. And that's all I ever wanted. All I chased was fame. I don't care about you. I don't care about relationships. I don't want kids. No kids. No kids. I knew I was too selfish to have kids, you know, too self-centered. I mean, that didn't stop other people, but at least I was a narcissist with a conscience. I just didn't want anything but this incredible showbiz career, which came with fame. I didn't necessarily want fame, but that was the byproduct of where I wanted to go, you know? So I almost get there, and then I have this big, you know. So this guy's in the audience. I meet him. The next morning, I'm at a red light. My hair's a mess. I still have makeup on from last night's show. It's like smeared all over my face. My hair's like on top of my head going, we don't know where he wants us to go. I'm in my laundry clothes, and I'm at a red light, and I look over, and on the corner is that guy, Pat, the one I met the night before. And we both do like this cartoon double take. It's like, oh my God. And I'm like, what's that guy doing there? Why is he, I'm like going, don't look. I don't like him. I don't want to go out with him. He's not my type. Don't look. But as I'm saying that, I hear this little voice that says, open the window, stupid. So I rolled the window down and I just kind of went, hi, Pat. And he tells me to pull into 7-Eleven, and I do. And I get out of my car and I just throw my arms around him and I just sob. I just sob and I just collapse in his arms. And I'm crying and crying and crying and crying. And he's just holding me, 7-Eleven parking lot. And then when I'm done crying, we go in and I pick out my ice cream. Now, what I do not know is he and my friend that had set us up, she worked right across. They worked right across the street from the 7-Eleven, which I did know, but I didn't know this part. She had just walked up to him in the office and said, hey, how'd you like my friend Debbie? Why don't you give her a call? And he was like, no, I'm not. No, no setups. No way. Uh-uh. No setups. I mean, maybe if I meet her naturally and I get to know her, but no setups. I'm going to 7-Eleven. Do you want anything? And he walked downstairs, and there I am at the light. Hi, Pat. And that's how and we got together at that moment. And that was like my first evidence that there was a higher power or a universe or something that had my back. Because I had been alone. I mean, really, I was on the road alone. I did my show alone. I didn't really have relationships because I didn't want anything in the way of me, you know? So we fall in love. And I don't know how to do it because I've been drunk during all the years when you're supposed to learn how to have a normal, healthy, happy relationship. I don't come from normal, happy. So he's all normal. You know, he's just this normal, nice guy from this loving family. Now, my family, we were loving, but no one knew how to do it. So the love sounded like, hey, putting on a little weight there, aren't you, Deb? I mean, the love came out as sarcasm and jabs, and you were you had to be on your feet because everybody was really witty. So we didn't talk with each other. We talked at each other, and someone was always the brunt of the conversation. So he and I get together, and he basically just shows me how it goes, how you have a relationship, and we fall in love, and right at the perfect time, because my whole career had just pfft. And about a couple years into, not a couple, 10 years into our relationship, he gets diagnosed with cancer, throat cancer. And the doctor says to him, let me back up and tell this part of the story because that's interesting. On about our 10th anniversary, we go to Italy. And we're in Rome, and we're at the old Forum of Rome, which is a ruins from Julius Caesar's time, right in the middle of Rome. Now, Pat—
The Colosseum?
Right next to the Colosseum is called the Forum.
Oh, okay.
They're the two major ruins in Rome. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been there, but
I've been to the Colosseum, so I probably
yeah. Well, too. You generally get a ticket for both.
Yeah.
So we had come from the Colosseum, and now we're in the Forum. Now, Pat was a lapsed Catholic. He didn't believe in religion, didn't talk about a God or a higher power. And if people started doing their woo-woo California stuff, he always was like, oh, cool. But it just wasn't his vibe, you know. He was a meat and potatoes Italian boy from New Jersey. If I see it, I believe it. If I don't, oh well. And we walked into the Forum, And it was 95 degrees, and we'd been doing this all day. And I'm like, you know, I just want to look and leave. And we walk in, and he's like, whoa, whoa. I'm like, what? No, I've been here before. And he'd never been to Europe. I've been here before. And I'm like, really? And he's like, I have lived here before. I'm like, really? Wow. And I couldn't get him out of there. He sat down on a rock and he meditated. He'd never meditated in his life. He sat down on a rock in the middle of the ruins and sat there all. I named him Paticus, and he just sat there for hours. And I, you know, I went and saw the rest of Rome. And the next day, he did the same thing. I said, what do you want on our last day in Rome? What do you, I want to go back. I'm like, okay. So we come home. He gets diagnosed with throat cancer. And the doctor says to him, you're not going to die. This, we can cure this. But it's going to be really horrible. You up for it? He's like, yep. So he goes through horrific throat radiation, which is like the worst, and lots of chemo. And then at the end of like a year, he has an operation, and they take out the whole left side of his throat. They take his jugular vein and that muscle. And I didn't even know you could live without a jugular vein. So he doesn't die, but he never gets well again. And he lives about the next 9.5 years just feeling rotten on and off. And this was a party boy. He just loved life. So, and my, I become this whole different person. Now I've got, you know, my career's just in the past at this point, and I'm taking care of this guy. My choice, I didn't have to, but of course I did have to. And we spend many, many years just with him being sick, maybe 3-4 days a week. You know, he'd have a good day. And he kept saying something's wrong, and I would take him to the doctor, and they kept saying, well, we, you know. Oh, and he had no insurance when this happened. We were both in showbiz. We had no health insurance when he got sick. So the doctor keeps taking x-rays from here up. And they're like, well, he's cancer-free. This is just the effects of the radiation. We're like, okay, thank you so much. Good job, you know. Good job on the radiation there. They were really over-radiating people at that point. So somewhere around our 20th anniversary, so he's been living this way for 8 or 9 years, he gets hit with the second cancer. Pancreatic, stage 4. So there was something wrong with him the whole time, but because we didn't have good insurance, nobody looked. And he kept telling me something's wrong, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what to say, honey, you know? So he gets diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and I take care of him, and he dies. And I had been with him, you know, the whole time. I'm taking care of him. Now, he had, you know, he got sick young. And his career just never got to where he wanted it to be. So he felt like, he's a macho Italian guy. He felt like a failure. You know, you guys, your whole ego is attached to, you know, your worth. And so is mine. I have a lot of male energy. But so he always would say to me, I'm a failure. And I would say, how could you possibly be a failure? You're one of the most beloved people I've ever met. You have this incredible family, this huge Italian family that just loved him. I said, you got so many people, and I'm not nothing. You got me. And so I would talk him off the ledge of thinking that he had failed. So after he dies, I go to visit a girlfriend who I'd lost touch with. She saw on Facebook that he had died, so she contacted me and invited me to come visit. And I went there, and she knew I was taking – so I decided to take Pat's ashes to Rome. He had told me he wanted his ashes to go to Julius Caesar's garden in Rome, where he felt he had lived. And I'm like, not a problem. His parents, his Italian family was like, what? What? I'm like, it's what he wanted. So I'm getting ready to take his ashes to Rome, and I'm visiting with his girlfriend, who doesn't know why I'm taking him to Rome. She figures it's just because he's Italian. And we're sitting in her living room, and she starts going like this, oh, I'm sorry. I hope this doesn't freak you out, but I'm an unwitting medium. Dead people talk to me. And I'm like, whatever, cool. And she goes, and Pat's here. And I'm like, okay. She goes, is that okay? And I'm like, yeah. So she's like up talking to him. She goes, okay. He just wants to know he's really, really glad you're going to Rome. He's really glad. And he's going to be with you the whole time. And I'm thinking, yeah, whatever, you know. And then she goes, oh, okay. He wants me to tell you that he wasn't a failure after all. She knew none of this. He wasn't a failure after all. Because apparently his job in this life was to find love. Because in a past life, apparently he was a mean motherfucker. He was a gladiator or something in Rome. And I'm like, wow. It just, okay. That was a moment, that was such a moment for me of just believing, really believing in everything. You know, everything that's good and possible and light and loving. And so that's the story there. And that was about 7 years ago. And it took me until he began to die to realize that he was the real love of my life, because I'd held on to this toxic, you know, the relationship I had first, it was toxic, but it was on fire. It was on fire. Not just sex. It was everything, you know, everything. And I just didn't know, because I'm, again, you know, a recovering alcoholic who hasn't figured life all out at this time. I didn't realize that, you know, that was just a very immature kind of love, and this was a more mature. And it was pretty much when we were told that he was going to die that I was like, oh my God, you know? He's the love of you. Are you, what an asshole. So, hey, am I allowed to be cursing here?
Absolutely.
I'm a Jersey chick. I can't not anyway.
Try to get us kicked off of YouTube.
Yeah, that's true. I think you have to have sex with a snake to get... No, mm-hmm. Not even that, right? So I really hesitate to tell this story because it sounds so... It sounds bullshit, but this is the truth. This happened before the whole finding out that he had had a life before in Rome. When I was, you know, the last couple of days I was with him, I felt the need to make sure he knew that he had been the love of my life, because we didn't meet till we were 40, and we both had these other big he had a really big one too, big ones, and he knew that I'd never really gotten through that whole thing. He knew it. And so I sat him, you know, I sat at his bedside the last couple days. I mean, he's already slipping in and out of consciousness. And I say, you do know that you're the love of my life. And he just kind of shakes his hand and goes like this, you know. And he doesn't say it back to me. And I'm like, well, am I the love of your life? And he squeezes my hand and goes, you know, same thing, because he can't talk already. And then about 2 weeks later, a friend of mine sent me to another, you know, I've only been to two mediums in my life, and they're both in this story. Sent me to a medium because when her husband died, this medium had connected her up with her husband, and she said it was just uncanny what she knew, stuff she never could have, really personal stuff. So I go to this woman, and I'm a little cynical. This is before the girlfriend who had channeled him at her house that day. I'm a little cynical and I'm there like this, but my girlfriend treated me. She goes, oh, I see, you know, your husband is here. And I'm like, we never got married. Partner. She goes, well, he's here. And oh, he loves you so much. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, it was so generic. You know, I'm like, tell me something I don't know. Tell me where the winning lottery ticket is, you know. Help me out here, lady. So she said, well, he just keeps talking about how much he loves you. I don't know what he's trying to say. I said, well, can we move on? And she's like, well, he just is still there. And finally she goes, oh, okay. He wants me to tell you that you're the love of his life too. And it was just like that. Like he was answering the question that I had posed like the week before. So right after he dies, I go through my grief period, which you do, you have to. And I completely get out of showbiz at this point because not only did I lose him, but we lost all our money. I mean, with the whole sickness, we lost everything. And then also around the same time, my older brother died. And then my best friend died. I lost my career. I just lost everything. So I got a job for the first time, like ever. And I did that for about 8 years. And the whole time I'm doing the job, I'm out of showbiz. I'm not doing anything, doing a little writing. Because I'm more of a writer at this point. I'm doing a little writing. But I'm just making money, which was nice because I didn't have it and I needed it. And it was just this unbelievable miracle that I finally had all this money coming my way. So I retired from that job last year and I started writing. I mean, the second that job was out, I started writing again. So now I'm back to who I'm supposed to be with a balance, if you know what I'm saying. I'm not insane. I have no aspirations of anything except doing the work, which was really how I got into theater to begin with. I just loved the work. And then I got all distorted. And, oh, I could be famous. Oh, I could make $1 billion. Oh, I could be, you know, I can get my own sitcom. And now I'm just back exactly where I'm supposed to be. Just doing the work that I love and holding this place in my heart for Pat, you know? And even for the guy that I was in the really sick relationship with, we have since made amends to each other. We made peace. We bumped into each other at a reunion. And he's sober and I'm sober. And it's the first time ever in like 45 years that we saw each other sober. It's like taking your clothes off for the first time. I'd been sober, but he was still showing up at parties and reunions drunk. So now we're both, and we just sat down and we've had this amazing, you know, making amends to each other about all the damage that we did. And we both, you know, we both had a lot of love for each other in our hearts still. But we realized almost at the same exact moment on the phone one night that what we were really in love with all these years was 1973. You know? It just happened to be we were together. We were in Vermont. We were discovering theater. We were acting. We were young. We were popular. We were discovering alcohol and drugs and sex. It was just, it was the whole package. So I can't wait to know what my next chapter is in this whole saga we call life.
That's wonderful. That's a great life. It's a great story.
Thanks.
And now you're doing comedy?
Yeah. Well, I don't do stand-up right now. I wrote a one-woman show about a lot of this about finding Pat just when I needed him, losing him. And it's basically about living as a obsessive compulsive addictive personality. The show is about that, because even when you sober up, you know, now I can't stop shopping, or I can't. During COVID, I became completely addicted to sugar. I just went, I mean, I literally gained.
What insights have you gained from your addiction to alcohol and then getting clean and then maybe replacing it with something else?
Insights? Well, the insights that I have about it is that you're never cured. You know, you don't cure alcoholism. You just have a reprieve with it one day at a time.
And you can find a replacement maybe?
Yeah, well, they call it whack-a-mole system, you know, the whack-a-mole, where one addiction goes down another. I mean, most alcoholics that I know either do too much food or too much gambling or too much, I mean, binging, the whole binge society right now. That was created for addictive personalities, you know. Let's give them 10 shows and they'll stay up all night watching. It's like, I can't stop. You know, it's just not being able to stop something that connects you to a better feeling than you were having. So I really bottomed out with sugar. And my insight is that I can't do it at all. Because every week I would say, Monday morning, I would say, well, just don't have sugar, Debbie, you know. And I'd make it 2 days and I'd be like, you know, I'd be having sugar again. So I just can't, you can't pick up. You just can't start. Do you know? That's the trick. You can't, if you're a gambleaholic, you can't go to Atlantic City. You can't go to Vegas and sit at a blackjack table and think that you're not going to gamble. And once you start, once you open those floodgates. So, obsessed about, you know, getting more laughs, more attention. It's just anything that feeds, you know, they say we're born with an empty hole in our heart. And we're just trying to fill it with the wrong thing. You know, they call it a God-sized hole. You got to fill it with something from within, you know. No amount of cookies are going to fit in there and make you go, I'm good, you know.
And what would you say is the most important lesson you've learned in your life?
In my life? Ooh! Obvious but tricky question there, Mark. The most important lesson I've learned in my life is that everything's going to be okay. Let go. Take action. Let go of the results, because you can't control them anyway, right? I'm not in the result business. I can't make somebody, you know, put me in a play. I can't make somebody buy my book. All I can do is take action. Let go of the results.
Beautiful. Great storytelling.
Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you.
All right.